Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, we're taking a journey with a doctorate in English literature. Adam Bradley is far from our usual journey. It's quite compelling. I hope you like it. Anyway, he was born in Los Angeles to a black father and a white mother. At the age of six, the family left L.A., off to Salt Lake City. He was homeschooled by his white grandmother, who opened the doors to art and literature for Adam, while his mother worked to help him engage with his African-American heritage through community action. Then it was off to college, a small liberal arts one up in the Pacific Northwest, where he found his passion. It was the writings of the African-American novelist that wrote The Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison.
And that idea of moving from this place of invisibility to a place of being a spokesperson, of speaking for others, tremendously empowering. And I saw in my story a lot of the arc of Invisible Man's own narrative.
So what did Adam do? Well, he grabbed hold of this idea of that Invisible Man narrative. He took it with him through college and on to graduate school. And then he decided to take a look at the literary contributions of rap music. And using those two items, that Invisible Man narrative and his love of rap music, he's building a foundation to explore the issues that are surrounding those uncomfortable issues and those uncomfortable conversations that we should be having about race and inequality.
Race and popular culture, to me, is a powerful nexus because it creates a space that at once puts us in the groove, puts us in a place of comfort and fun. It also interjects these often challenging conversations that otherwise we might not want to engage in.
And given the events in Charlottesville, Virginia this last weekend, I can't think of a better time to have the conversation. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conte Jr. Check out the website for some of my writings and past podcast episodes. That's themountaingeek.net. You should also be able to listen to most episodes, if not all of them, on your favorite podcast distribution channel. And on the social media, on Twitter, at The Mountain Geek, also Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Now, the background music you hear there is from Common, and it'll make more sense a little later on as Adam and I are talking as to why I have Common today as the music. Well, hope you enjoy. And Adam Bradley and I, we've got our shovels. Gonna start shoveling.
Because I'm an old radio guy, I still like having earphones
so
in.
So the cans on.
Yeah, I gotta have the cans on. And I find that I'm listening to them at a higher volume all the time.
It's all those shows.
It's all the shows, yeah. So next show is in September. I'm going back. In my deep down, my musical structure is built on progressive rock. Mm-hmm. I'm a prog guy. And no pun intended, but I'm going to click off my bucket list, Buckethead, at the Fox Theater.
They're playing the Fox.
Next month, yeah. So I don't know if you're familiar with Buckethead at all.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so it'll be a lot of fun. Adam Bradley, thank you very much for inviting me here to the Rap Lab, and we'll talk about what the Rap Lab is here at the University of Colorado, my old stomping ground. It's always fun. I got to tell you, this is the first time I've walked into that door. Usually when I walked into the chemistry building, it was for movies at Chem 140.
Yeah.
And then a failed attempt at two chemistry classes. So I did not spend a lot of time here.
You know that, and same with me. I'd never even walked in the building until I found out that I had space in it. So it's been a nice adventure to be around all of these actual scientists as I try to do my own lab.
Do you get a sense that talking to scientists changes maybe the way that you think about the work that you're doing? Because you're coming from an English background, obviously, we'll get into that. But the scientific theory, the way that they ask questions, how is that different from what you grew up learning how to ask? And how is that changing what your progression is now?
That's the key, I think. And that's one of the wonderful things about being in a space where at least you absorb through osmosis. I have to check the science on that, but through some process,
I think that's right. Yeah, it's either osmosis or diffusion. I could never get it right.
Something, but I'm absorbing some of those same practices, and it can be something as simple as even seeing how my colleagues in the sciences set up their labs, work with grad students, work with undergraduate students, co-author papers with graduate students. These kinds of things are a great inspiration to me, because I'm emerging out of a context in the humanities where we're pretty much lone wolves. We're out there doing our projects, writing our books and articles, having very little contact with each other, or certainly with graduate students in that research-based context. So it became an inspiration to rethink how I work with graduate students, how I think about my responsibility as a mentor to doctoral students, how I think about my responsibilities as a mentor to my undergrads, and how to work them into the flow of my research in more integral ways.
Would you have seen yourself in this position 20 years ago?
Man, 20 years ago, it takes me right into the thick of beginning my graduate education, I guess, very end of undergrad. You know, I guess in part, yes. In part, I look back and I always knew I wanted to be a writer first. And then once I figured out what a professor did, I decided that's a pretty good gig too. So I think certainly by age 23, I was thinking that it was an inevitability that I'd be in some form of higher education. Now, running a lab, now that's a different matter, and that's a good portion of what I do nowadays in addition to the more conventional professorial responsibilities. That's been something new, and that's something I've had to learn on the fly. I had to improvise a lot, and I continue to improvise what it means to direct a lab, what it means to head up research projects in the fashion that I do now.
So let's talk about this. What is the RAP Lab?
The RAP Lab is the Laboratory for Race and Popular Culture. I conceived of it about 5 years ago as a way to help me do the work that I want to do on this campus, that I want to do more generally as I move through the world, which is to think about popular culture, music, film, the whole array of ways that culture expresses itself through the lens of our American racial past, present, and future. And to do that in a way that's collaborative, that involves the three core elements of a professor's life, which are the research, teaching, and service or outreach. I imagine that everything that the lab did, every one of our initiatives, would involve at least two, if not all three, of those things at once. We would collapse the boundaries that often get put up to block cutting-edge research from the work that you're doing in the classroom, that separate the work that we do in the community and, you know, the campus community and the community more broadly, and the research and teaching that we're doing. I wanted to find ways to collapse those things and to do the kind of work that I had already begun and I saw a lot of other people on this campus doing, to forge new relationships and partnerships across the campus and beyond in these matters. So over the course of the last 5 years, the lab has shifted shape, and that's part of its mission as well. It's not supposed to be just one thing, where you might have a center that's focused on international affairs, that's focused narrowly on, you know, some specific topic, something like the Center for the American West, which is a longstanding, very successful center on campus. That has a mission that's clear. The lab is intentionally fuzzy because I want it to respond to the needs of the moment. I want it to respond to the people involved. I want the projects we do to emerge organically out of that synthesis. So over the last several years, we've involved close to 60 students, graduate and undergraduate students. We've done close to 8 different projects, some of which are ongoing, some of which have eclipsed, some of which are still on the horizon. Those include a longstanding collaboration now with a group of inmates at a Colorado prison in Ordway, And we've been working to support their efforts in designing a more holistic response to the challenge of gang violence and gang tension on the prison site. That's one of the things. And yet on the very other spectrum, we're working on song lyric and working with how to bring song lyric into the K-12 classroom as a means to activate students' interest in the language arts and connect them more directly with a passion for writing, reading, and rhetoric.
You mentioned something that I think is pretty interesting, and it's in the name. It's race and popular culture. You said that you want the lab to be fuzzy, and that makes sense because popular culture is constantly changing. It's always moving. It's you know, what was popular a week ago is not going to be popular in 3 days. You know, even more so in today's internet, mm-hmm. that, you know, it is that, you know, 30-second news cycle. Yep. And it's not just the news, it's popular culture. I had read Kesha has a new album out. 5 years ago, she was the it girl.
Yeah.
Now, you know, through some other things, is she going to return and be that driving force in popular culture? So those are some of the things that you're talking about.
Exactly. As you say, popular culture moves at the speed of light, or maybe light moves at the speed of popular culture. It's such rapid shifting of shapes that occur. And yet for all of that, there's certain bedrock qualities, certain bedrock elements that we can identify and use to think about popular culture across all of those shifts. Even the very fact of its changeability is one of those fixtures. This is as true in the 1920s, in the jazz age, as it was today, the shifting dance styles, for instance, of that moment, or the ways that people were evolving how to play a horn, how to sing a standard, how to do these sorts of things. These things are in constant flux. And so part of our job through the lab and part of my goal as someone who researches and writes about the intersection of race, popular culture, of literature and music, and all of these intersections, the things that I look to are the abiding continuities that help us get a fix on what otherwise might be chaotically shifting.
I've said it before in past episodes when I've talked to other people that are here on campus, and I knew growing up in this university environment, the University of Colorado Boulder, I love this place. I bleed black and gold. But it's a white, white environment. Yeah. And when you talk about race and popular culture here, how is it that you're able to balance out, you know, a 95% white student population here, but a student population, when you take a look at, you know, let's talk about music popular culture.
Yeah.
The top 40 music, that's dominated by African-American artists,
yeah,
by the black artist. I don't know exactly where I'm going with this idea, but in a white environment with such a heavy black influence,
yeah,
where do you go with that sensibility?
Yeah, so
does that make sense?
That definitely makes sense. I came to Boulder from Los Angeles, which clearly is a place with a lot more diversity.
Right.
I came to Los Angeles from the East Coast, from New York, Boston, and D.C. Much more diversity in the racial and ethnic spectrum. Yet I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. a brown kid in a predominantly white space. So just on a personal level, I'm quite accustomed to being the one to raise matters of racial diversity and difference in a space that's predominated by those who have the luxury not to think about it. And I've found that to be a powerful platform and an important work to do, to inhabit spaces where it's all too easy to overlook the diversity that surrounds us. Just one example, I have a graduate student who did an event around Boulder, I won't say where, but it was introducing a film, And during the back and forth with the audience about the film, this an older gentleman in the audience said, and this film was about racial difference, particularly about the black-white color line. And this older gentleman said, well, in Boulder, we really don't have to think about this, do we? Because there are no black people here. And the thing that's so astounding is that he could look around the room and see at least three or four black people.
Right.
He could look around the campus and see people like me, people like my colleagues across in ethnic studies and elsewhere who are doing work related to race. But he could also see that there is a dominant racial paradigm here, a dominant cultural and political paradigm as well, that often allows us to get a little lazy about these matters. Because race is an uncomfortable subject. It's so uncomfortable that sometimes it takes the ease of music, the fun of it, the play of it, for us to engage with it. Hence, race and popular culture, to me, is a powerful nexus because it creates a space that at once puts us in the groove, puts us in a place of comfort and fun, yet also interjects these often challenging conversations that otherwise we might not want to engage in. That's what I hope that my work does throughout, that it creates spaces to have conversations, not to shame anybody or make people feel silly or stupid, just as my graduate student didn't shame that man, but to create spaces where he can have an awakening, have an understanding, and we can all have a better conversation about what it means to be in a multiracial American democratic experiment like this.
It is still an experiment. We won't go down that road right now because better left.
Okay, so let's jump to the beginning here. Growing up in Salt Lake City, it really doesn't get much more white than Salt Lake City.
Particularly then in the 80s,
right.
And, you know, much more so even than today, post-Olympics, when it's a little bit more of a cosmopolitan
right.
city.
It is. Tell me about your family growing up in Salt Lake. Is that you were born in Salt Lake City?
I was born in Salt Lake City. My father, who is black, and that side of my family lives in Los Angeles. My mother grew up in Salt Lake City, and I grew up with my mother and my mother's parents, my grandparents on my maternal side. And so I grew up as the one biracial kid that I knew up until high school, pretty much. I grew up with a younger brother who had a different father who was entirely white. And so therefore, from a very early age, I was cognizant of my difference. I was cognizant of my difference both in the community at large, but even in my own home.
What did your mom do for a living to support your family?
My mother went back to college initially. She had me when she was 23 years old. And she went back to college, got her degree, and then went on to get a master's in fine arts. She was and remains a painter and spent a long time in the burgeoning field of computer graphics at the time. So various kinds of modeling, working with early game companies in the late 80s and early 90s as well. So that was her thing. Both of my grandparents were educators. My grandfather was a professor at the University of Utah and the dean of the business college at one point. My grandmother was a high school art history and English teacher at a Catholic school in Salt Lake. And she quit her job when my mother and I and my younger brother moved back to Salt Lake City from California, where we had been living. She quit her job to teach me at home. And she taught me at home until high school, from about age 6 until I started my sophomore year of high school.
What was she looking out for you?
The impetus behind that?
Yeah, I mean, what was the impetus behind
that? Yeah, well, it's part of the reason why we left California, in fact. And as a parent now of young children of about this age, I have come to appreciate my mother's bravery even more in the decision she made. So essentially it was this. I was in first grade. My daughter's starting first grade in 1 week, so this is on my mind.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, I'm about 6 or 7 years old, and my mother's called into parent-teacher conference, and the teacher says, Adam, he's the sweetest boy in class, but he's just not that bright. He's struggling to read. He can't keep up with the other kids. We're thinking about that you might consider holding him back, and it's just he's not right for this. So my mother, a fiery redhead, pulled me out of school, pulled us out of the state of California and moved back initially with her parents in Salt Lake. And that was a tough decision on her part. Her marriage was ending at the time as well to my brother's father, so maybe it was a nice moment to have a clean break, but we took it. So my mother sacrificed, and my grandmother also sacrificed. She saw me, and she said, I can teach this boy to read in no time. This boy is brilliant, she thought. Still try to prove it to her now that she's gone. And she taught me within what seemed like a matter of weeks, if not months. I was reading everything. I was reading the back of the cereal box. I was everything.
Do you remember not being able to read and then making that transition to going, these words mean something to me?
Yes. It was an amazing moment. And I think it helped, too, that I was learning to read at the same time as that I was learning to write, and specifically at the same time as I was learning to write poetry. Some of the first words I wrote on my own were poetry. My grandmother would give me a pencil and a pad, and she'd send me out to her rose garden. And she had this beautiful yard that she manicured carefully, and she'd say, just write about what you see and smell and all, you know, use your senses and put words down to see what comes out. And that's what I'd do. I'd talk about the plane cutting a contrail across the sky, or the bees buzzing around a particular bud of her rose bush, and that would be what I'd do. And you know, so it's, I think that was the power of poetry for me in that moment, was the confluence of the awakening to language, and the awakening specifically through this kind of condensed expression that's sensory driven, that luxuriates in the sounds of words as well as their sense. And my grandmother made that clear to me early on, that that's what words could do.
Being an art teacher in high school, certainly going to be that drive and be the focus as you can't help but pass that passion onto kids. We do that no matter what it is that we do, as a love, and we send that to our children. When you made the transition then to high school, how, we got a couple of things to get through. First of all, you're the focus of one single person's attention. How does that go? How did you do with that transition from, hey, grandma, to, oh my gosh, Mrs. Smith, how do I deal with, 20 other kids, 25 other kids in the classroom?
Oh, I mean, that was a challenge. And I have to say that it's easier to tell the story as a smooth move from homeschool into high school. But there were attempts along the way, because I think my family felt a certain concern that I wasn't getting socialized, that I wasn't building close friendships. So from time to time, we'd actually try school out. Like, I tried out third grade for a while. I think I made it through most of the year, maybe. But then fourth, something happened, and they pulled me out. All along, I'd have to be tested by the district to make sure I was keeping up to standard, and I was always grade levels ahead. Right. But that initial transition to high school, I began in my grandmother's former school, Judge Memorial Catholic High School in Salt Lake City, and it was ninth grade. I spent one semester there, and it's the only part of my life I cannot remember.
Really?
I blocked it out. It was that kind of trauma, deep, deep trauma. I do know, just from the transcripts, which I still have, that I received an A+ in math and an F in English. And now I can barely balance my checkbook, right, and I'm a professor of English, so go figure. But it was a deep trauma, and the trauma was based, I think, on the diving into this cold pool of social life at this tough age, 14, 15, whatever I was at the time. That's a very, very tricky time to be a new kid and to be a new kid who's never been in school to speak of. And on top of that, there was a racial element. I remember facing, for the first time that I can recall, pretty significant racial animus from people, you know, being called the N-word, being mocked and ridiculed, being, you know, all those kinds of things. The reason why I also flunked gym was that I stopped going because I kept getting bullied. I'm a big dude. I mean, you can't see right. me on the radio, but I'm 6'4", you know, over 200 pounds at the time. I mean, I was close to probably six feet at that time and, you know, 180 maybe, and I'm a big kid.
Right.
And
were you a sporty kid at all?
Yeah. I played basketball. My grandfather had been a professional basketball player.
Okay.
And I tried out for the team and broke my thumb, and which was unfortunate during tryouts. Maybe that would have helped the transition. Maybe, but I'll never know. But all I know is it was a tremendous point of great turmoil in my life, to the point where even to this day, as you know, recently turned 43-year-old man, I cannot remember that right. time. Now, 10th grade, starting at a large public high school, Olympus High School in Salt Lake, nearly 2,000 kids enrolled, only 2.5 black kids. I was the half. That surprisingly was a wonderful transition. And I think in part it was because of the place, because I was there was such little diversity that in some ways I was just a curiosity, whereas at Judge it was much more diverse. And so they had already drawn their battle lines
okay.
along racial lines. I think, too, I had a better mindset. I'd really wanted a rich social life when I started at the Catholic high school, but when I went to the public high school, I said, you know what, forget it. I'm just going to be the best student I can be. And I doubled down on it and focused almost exclusively on my work, my studies, later journalism.
What were those studies? In high school, what is it that drove you? Where did you find your successes? And what were those successes that provided you the base?
And that's the key word, Ted, is successes, because I'd had, of course, recognition in my home setting, but starting that big high school, that big public high school, was the first time that I'd felt that I was achieving success that others recognize, and there's a power to that because they don't have any necessary investment in you or a kind of a stake in you doing great.
Right.
And I had that, and sometimes it comes down to individual teachers. That's what I found even in my graduate education when I look back on my PhD work as well. It's the individual teachers that stand out more than the courses, more than the books I read or anything I wrote. And so for me, that was Mr. Jim Felt, and he taught history. And I took whatever course I could. He was also the advisor for the school newspaper. So as I just tried to follow around what he did, whatever he was teaching, if I could get into it, I would. So world history, then European history. I did journalism, starting out as just a peon and ultimately being the editor-in-chief by my senior year. So I found that success in the reflection of his observation of me and of my growth. And that was a really powerful thing as a kid.
That's a pretty common thread I'm finding, is that whether it's high school and college, it's that graduate program, one of the keys to success, or maybe even the biggest key to success, is finding a mentor, somebody that is willing to give you everything, yeah. answer every question you have, not close the door on you. That's a real key to the success. I think it's in any profession, but you know, I've got it professionally as a boring old insurance guy, but I think in academics, it's finding that one person that is going to, for lack of a better term, be your guiding light.
Yeah.
In this process, you found it in high school.
Yeah.
Did you find it in college?
Oh yeah. And I mean, it's important to recall that this whole education thing is essentially a guild in a way, and works on a similar process where you have mentors, you have people who bring you into the practice, who initiate you into the various elements of the craft. And college, I had my greatest mentor of all, in fact, and someone I met when I was 18 years old visiting the campus. And this was a big thing. So I applied to 13 schools, which at the time was a lot. Now I hear kids applying to like 50 and 60 schools. And
having a daughter that's a sophomore in college. It's 13 schools is nothing. It's
in 92. It felt like a lot. And I applied to a lot that were close, but I also wanted to leave.
Did you feel the need to? Yeah. Did you feel the need to leave the nest?
Yes.
Was it a big call to
go?
Yes,
because, and I laugh about this to this day, I was such a model kid in some ways. I saved all my misbehavior for grad school even. So I was such a goody-two-shoes in a lot of ways and so sheltered. But there was a part of me that knew I needed to challenge myself by stepping away from the family. So I ended up applying to those schools, most of which were in the West Coast, a couple in the East, and it narrowed down to Pomona, down in Southern California, and Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. And strangely enough, the third one was Morehouse College, the all-black male university in Atlanta.
Real quick, just off the top of my head, was that a drive? Did you have... This is going to sound bad, but did you have a calling to dive into black African American culture that you had not had growing up in Whiteyville, Salt Lake City?
My blackness was fairly abstract up to that point. It was based in books that my mother would give me. It was based in music, of course.
Did you have any enemy? I'll just ask. Did you have any contact with your father?
I met my father. I met my father in my late 20s.
Okay.
So I had no contact. He saw me at 6 months old, and then not again until I was a professor in my first year as a professor. So no contact. So I didn't have a contact with the black side of my family. I had very limited contact with black people in Salt Lake City. I mean, my mom and I actually joined the NAACP in 1991 when I was in high school and went to a couple meetings there, and that was pretty much the extent of it. As applying to college, I was mindful of wanting to find a more diverse community, and particularly a black community that would allow me to understand that part of myself more clearly through those interactions. So it was quite something when the recruiter from Morehouse, the historically black, one of the most famous historically black colleges, came all the way to Salt Lake to meet with me, just me. That was a moment. We sat down and had dinner at this Mexican restaurant, and he said, "Yeah, you're the only buddy in the state of Utah that we're recruiting, and we'd really love you to come out." And I thought a lot about it, but ultimately, what tipped the scale was being a bit closer to home in Portland, Oregon, and also winning a full scholarship. But the thing that allowed me to do that and still feel like I could cultivate my identity more fully was the visit that they did. They were very smart. They brought up me and a bunch of other students of color, so mostly black and Latino students, on a special weekend. There were about 30 of us. And I was ready to sign up as soon as I saw the girls. Now, of course, none of them ended up coming to the college, but at the time I was like, man, no, this is the best thing ever. Please, let me sign up now. But it ended up being good for other reasons as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, Portland's a pretty white place as well.
Yeah. Although it has a rich, historically black section of town in northeast Portland that has a community, has a sense of community. I used to, once I'd been in the university for a while and cultivated some friendships, the guys, a lot of the other guys, the black guys, we would drive out to Northeast Portland to get our hair cut.
Okay.
And eventually the barber would end up coming to campus, driving to us and getting our hair cut, because particularly back then, the style was the bald fade. So you had to get your haircut at least every 10 days just to maintain it. So that was one of my best partners was the barber, because I had to see him, you know, 4 or 5 times a month.
You had mentioned, though, cultivating very early on a relationship.
Yeah, mentor.
A mentor at Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
While you were visiting there?
Yeah. So it was one of the first people I remember meeting on campus. It was a faculty member named John Callahan. And John Callahan is by no means a black man. He's of Irish descent, raised in Connecticut. But he taught African-American literature and was one of the preeminent scholars of African-American literature, close friends with people like Alice Walker. He knew Toni Morrison. He knew the great Ralph Ellison, author of Invisible Man. And he talked to me in ways that made me feel like I might be able to work with him, that he was deeply interested in me and in my background and in my capacities. And sure enough, by that first year, when I took a class with him, he saw something in me to where he did something that I look back on it now and is pretty remarkable. In this large lecture class, at least large for a small liberal arts college, he had these section leaders, all seniors, and me. And he had me leading an entire section, discussion section of the course with upperclassmen being basically tutored by me.
Had you been exposed to those authors in high school? Were you able to get to those on your own, or did you have, or did you have somebody in high school helping you gather
up?
It was a mix.
We definitely read. I can recall reading Richard Wright, Native Son and Black Boy, in high school, and then I did quite a lot of reading on my own because I didn't have any friends.
When did you read Invisible Man?
I read Invisible Man for the first time as a freshman, as a first year student in John Callahan's course, and it blew my mind, because here was this book about racial identity, about a young man who begins the novel saying, "I am an invisible man." And by the end of the novel, he says, "And it is this which frightens me. Who knows but that on the lower frequencies, I speak for you." And that idea of moving from this place of invisibility to a place of being a spokesperson, of speaking for others, tremendously empowering. And I saw in my story a lot of the arc of Invisible Man's own narrative. And that's no mistake. I think it's Invisible Man is a novel, you know, written in 52 that responds to a moment, a critical moment in America's racial history, just after segregation, really the moment that segregation is starting to founder in the law with Brown versus the Board of Education. And then the, of course, through the 60s, the landmark legislation that would dismantle at least the forward-facing state segregation. So all of that is going on, and it's a racialized transformation that this character is going through, but it's also a transformation that is universal in its applicability, that we all, particularly as young people, are in the process of constructing and piecing together what it is that we want to be, who it is that we want to be. And that's something I was going through, both in the specific element of my racial identity and then in the broader element of just being a 18-year-old kid.
Yeah, on the cusp of, so that's 18-year-old kid on the cusp of beginning a college career, yeah, and turning from Invisible Man, and probably while reading that, understanding what your opportunities are going to be at the end of that 4 years. I want to get into the 4 years, but the first question I want to ask first, going into college, did you have any expectations of graduate school and beyond, or what were you thinking, to the best of your recollection, what do you remember thinking about, this is what my goal is going to be at the end of this 4 years?
I know quite specifically what it was, because my grandmother had gotten to the edge of getting her doctorate. My grandfather had several master's degrees. My mother had just was in the process of getting her master's. So it was understood that you go to college. In fact, my grandmother said, you know, jokingly, she said, I won't even come to your college graduation. I expect you to get that degree.
Right. Gotcha.
It's the next one that matters. But for me, I was thinking law school. I was thinking law school up until the very end of my college education, up to my senior year when I took the LSATs and the GREs. And
why law school?
Was ready to go. I think part of it was, now looking back, particularly since I married an attorney, a naive vision. I thought, you know, I want to work on race relations. I want to be a civil rights attorney. I didn't exactly know what that meant. I just knew that there was this grand legacy of people who were labeled civil rights attorneys. I thought, well, I could be in that lineage. So I wanted to do public service through law, and thinking that law was the best way to affect change. And that's really what it was. So for the longest time, up until the very end, and even into my graduate education, I was still thinking of law.
What was, so the next 4 years, as you're preparing for this idea of becoming a lawyer, but you're focused on English?
Yeah.
You're focused on the written word, on what are the classes that are driving you and you're getting the most out of?
That's the problem, is that I tried to go the poli-sci track because I thought, well, that's probably the best preparation for law school. Meanwhile, English is a wonderful preparation for law school, just a free ad for my right. my discipline. but so for the longest time, I was thinking I got to learn about civic matters, and I have to learn economics and all of that. So I was pursuing those things. But I kept being seduced by literature, by language, that pull that I recall from being 6 or 7 years old, the pull of language, the beauty of words, all of those things were tugging on me. And it wasn't long before, in my sophomore year, I had the biggest draw of all, which was when that professor, John F. Callahan, became Ralph Ellison's literary executor upon Ellison's passing in 1994. And at that moment, he asked me to be his research assistant. And that was game over, because I was thinking, even though I didn't know it, I didn't realize it at the time.
Right.
Now looking back and reconstructing the arc of my career, I can say that was the moment when, forget whatever other things I had in my mind, I was destined to be a scholar. I was destined to be a writer. Just handling those pages, I can recall being at the attic, in the attic of this old manor house on the campus that the president of the college had allowed John to use. And so I was lugging all these boxes up there of Ellison's manuscripts.
So, and let's be perfectly clear, the first step of being a research assistant is the hard physical labor.
Yeah. It's not sexy. It's not, you know, I thought, wow, this, I was thinking, man, I'm going to be the next, I don't know, Indiana Jones of literature.
I'm going to
be discovering all this stuff. And the first thing John said, Professor Callahan at the time said to me is, do you see that box of papers over there? And I was thinking, oh yeah, he's going to tell me to search for the missing manuscript page, the beginning of the second novel that Ellison had never published. And he said, I want you to lug that up to the top of this manor house. There's a big table. There's a 15-foot-long table, and I want you to start stacking these things up. And so that's what I did. A lot of photocopying, a lot of pretty not very glamorous right. things, let's say. But he said, after you've done all of that work, if you've completed it and you have some time left, then you're free to look around, see what you see. And this was amazing because he was otherwise engaged at the time. He was editing what became the Collected Essays of Ralph Ellison, his the kind of the magnum opus of Ellison's essays, and so he wasn't thinking about these other manuscript pages at the time. He hadn't gotten into them yet. So I was looking at these and thinking, I'm probably maybe the third person to hold this page. Ralph Ellison, his wife. And now me, 19-year-old kid. It was remarkable. And that was the moment of kind of seduction to it, because of the excitement of these artifacts and seeing how Ellison went about the process of his composition, seeing how he would start on one page and I would read a sentence and I'd think, man, you know, here's a problem with this sentence. He needs a comma here, or he needs to fix this. The rhythm's off. Even as a kid, thinking I could improve on the prose, and thinking it's blasphemy. How dare I even think this? But then turning around and digging further in and seeing another draft, and seeing the revisions, both the ones that I imagined and others that I couldn't even conceive at the time, seeing how he honed his prose so carefully, so meticulously, and understanding that the works of literature that we often think of as pieces of perfection are born of this labor, born of this necessary labor with the imperfect, with these fragmentary and sometimes ill-fitting pieces. And that was tremendously empowering at once for me, because it made me think, well, maybe I can take these papers that I'm writing right now that don't seem up to much and hone them and hone them and hone them and get my prose to where it sings like his. Tremendously empowering, but also daunting, because it looked like hard work.
Was that a process? Did that take you through your last 3 years of college?
I spent every summer in one form or fashion throughout my undergraduate career and during the year as well, working with Professor Callahan on Ralph Ellison's papers, particularly the second novel that Ellison had begun shortly after the publication of his National Book Award-winning first novel, Invisible Man, and that he had never published over the last half of his life up until he died at 80.
I mean, it's a story that's very similar to Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
The name escapes me.
Harper Lee.
Yeah. And then shortly before she dies a couple of years ago, now we have this other book that comes out that, whether or not that, that's the follow-up novel. Mm. What were you able to put together? Callahan's working on these other books on the essays and selected writings. Mm-hmm. I seem to recall, just in the back of my brain somewhere, there was another novella or short novel in there.
Yeah. So the first iteration of the second novel came out in 1999 under the title Juneteenth, and it was what John Callahan edited it, and he identified it as the central fragment, the central narrative fragment from this sprawling second novel that Ellison had written. I had no involvement in that because in 99 I was deep in the middle of my graduate education. I was writing my dissertation at the time. I just passed my qualifying exams and had just earned my master's and was in the continuing program to get the doctorate at Harvard.
Oh, okay. So, all right, let's put that aside real quick here. Yeah. And then, because I do want to talk about going from Lewis and Clark to Harvard. Finish up what it was that you were then doing for Callahan.
In those early years.
And then walk me through that going from Portland to Boston.
Yeah.
Because that's a big, that's a monumental step.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was. So as far as the work with John Callahan, the thing that ultimately we ended up focusing on is trying to establish a basic sequence of Ellison's second novel, particularly as Ellison had imagined it in the last years of his life, writing on a personal computer. Ellison was among the first major authors to shift the bulk of his composition to a computer. He did this around 81, 82, when he first bought this thing called an Osborne 1, and then an Osborne 2, which he just hammered away at with this 3-inch green screen monitor.
Yeah.
it basically looked like a sewing machine, and he would pound away at that thing draft upon draft upon draft. So what I did is I took all of these hundreds of drafts, printed them out, identified them, put them into as best of a narrative fragments as I could, these sequences of text, and
Hold
made
on.
Those available for John Callahan.
The Osborne, was that the 10-inch floppy or the 3.5-inch
floppy?
Oh, my
goodness, that's a good question. It's been a while. Well,
anyway, how do you find it? So if it's 19, if it's the mid-90s, how are you pulling off the data off of those discs?
Yeah.
Off of those discs.
Well, all that was done through Ellison's estate. So his attorneys had the hardware.
Oh, okay.
And they hired a computer expert, actually a friend of Ellison's, to get all the data off, and they sent them in another kind of antiquated hardware, what was it called? Those little, not DAT, but like a little, essentially a
higher density, removable disk, right?
Disc. I remember those. Yeah, I forget what they were called, but yeah, so we had those things that now I don't have any way of reading.
Right.
And use that. And John Callahan is old school. He likes print. So the first thing I did was just print all of it out.
So essentially, the reason that most of the Northwest forests are down is because Callahan.
Pretty much, yeah. Because this, we're talking thousands
of pages.
Thousands of pages. We're talking probably just under 4,000 pages that he had produced of drafts on the computer.
When we're talking about drafts, had Ellison completed the novel at any point, or was he just constantly revising and getting farther along in his process?
Yeah, I mean, that's the wonder of his composition practice. And as someone now, myself, working on my seventh book, I know that every book is different. And there's some books where you have a clear conception of where things are going to end, and there are others that you let unfurl in some ways. And certainly in writing fiction, I can imagine that was the case. But he worked episodically, so he would think about, say, the episode of us talking, and he might render it initially from my point of view, then shift it to yours, then go to an omniscient point of view, with a consciousness looking right down upon us as we talk. He would do that multiple times with different scenes, and all drawn from this core narrative about a young boy of indeterminate race, Ellison calls him, by the name of Bliss, who is raised by a black preacher named Alonzo Zuber Hickman, A.Z. Hickman, and ends up leaving the fold as a young man and striking out on his own and passing as white, and ultimately coming to power as a senator from New England states, a racist senator, anti-black senator. So it's the course of unfurling all of this history, all of these complex matters of crossing the color line and identity, and all of this is at the core of the narrative. But from that, Ellison unfurls dozens of stories, dozens of characters. It's a much, much more ambitious novel than Invisible Man, which had been centered in the first person singular, the I, right, of one young black male. This is so much richer, so much more embodying the totality of the American experience from, you know, the Native American context, the black context, the white context, and everything in between.
Did you get the sense that he talked to a lot of people while writing this? Or, I mean, I remember vaguely reading Invisible Man freshman in college.
Yeah.
And knowing that was the, you know, for all we knew, that was the only thing he wrote.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe he is much like the character of James Earl Jones. As you're talking about this, I'm wondering if he's maybe not that James Earl Jones type character in the baseball, the Kevin Costner
Field
baseball
of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. Is he that type of not shut in but recluse? Who everybody is waiting for the next for his next great novel to come out, but or is Ellison the type of guy? Is he out and about in his age, in his later years? Is he talking to people, really getting those background stories to fill those characters?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. He was certainly a private person, and he was private in particular about his writing. He didn't often share the drafts of his manuscript, certainly of the second novel, with too many people. With Invisible Man, for instance, he had a core group of close friends and advisors whom he'd have read portions of it. Not so with the second novel, particularly in the later years. He moved away from that, became much more insular in the process of the novel. That corresponded, though, with his moment of being a very public person. So he's the Albert Schweitzer professor at NYU. So he's teaching students. He is in constant process of communication through written correspondence and other means with with writers and scholars and just general everyday people. One of the things that John Callahan is working on now is collected letters of Ellison, and it's miraculous to see him writing to a high school kid who asked him a question about Invisible Man in 1987 or something.
Right.
You know, things like that. So you see that throughout. He's very much engaged with the world, maybe not in the ways that some people would have liked for him to have been. Some people wanted him to be more political. He worked through the engines of government as an artist, always understood his identity as such. And so he was involved, for instance, with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the emergence of PBS. That was something that was very important to him, always concerned about education. So yeah, I think he was in the mix of the culture, both as an observer and as a participant. In some ways, like Stephen Dedalus in one of Ellison's favorite novels, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man by Joyce, he is that artistic observer on the pitch of play, disengaged sometimes from the active sport itself, but watching the colors, the motion, the action that a novelist, that a writer of any kind necessarily observes.
So other than Ellison, what other authors are you devouring in college? What?
Chuck D, Ice Cube.
So
Biggie, Tupac.
Right.
Yeah.
So rap.
Yeah.
So early, although it's not early by that time, I mean, and by the 90s, rap becomes hip hop.
Yeah.
So that's what, that's your biggest influence?
Yeah, I think so. I was fortunate to be in college at this moment of a real flowering and expanding of hip-hop culture to include a host of styles that hadn't to that point been so readily apparent, whether it's the jazz-inflected styles of A Tribe Called Quest, the boho sensibilities of De La Soul, the tripped-out, weeded and dusted sounds of the Wu-Tang Clan or Cypress Hill from the West Coast. Just all of this music is coming out in this moment. The political consciousness of Chuck D and Public Enemy, Brand Nubian, these kinds of groups. And then on the later half, the emergence of a group like the Fugees with a voice, Lauryn Hill, you know, as a singer, but also as a rapper, her mastery of both forms. These were things that I thought of as continuous with my literary studies, where I'm reading, you know, Beowulf, I'm reading the entire catalog of Shakespeare's plays.
But that is not, I mean, you're really thinking outside the box there, because nobody is, at that time, and it's not just hip-hop, you know, up until that time, you know, Bob Dylan was seen as an amazing poet. You know, people acknowledge the words that were being put to music, but I don't think anybody really had given musicians, well, maybe Bruce a little bit, but nobody really looked upon musicians as being impactful on the literary art form.
No, because I think even those artists that you mentioned that were allowed past the velvet rope did so because their lyrics could comport themselves as page-born poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So one can read certain Bob Dylan lyrics and see within it the very qualities that we look to in poetry meant for the page. Same with Springsteen or Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, just a handful of others. But you go to other kinds of linguistic play, other kinds of impacts. You don't even need to go to hip hop necessarily, but even in the rock canon, and in even in, you know, someone like Chuck Berry, for instance, in the early rock and roll canon, there's not the same kind of obscurity and opacity that often mistakes itself as great poetry. He's pretty explicit with what he's talking about. Even when he has a metaphor, it's pretty easy to
well,
know
absolutely.
What it's about.
Well, I think that it's easy to say that about, you know, music,
most popular music of that time, mm-hmm. or popular music period, the majority of it is, we want to be, you know, let's bump uglies.
Yeah,
that's what that's what it's about. And let's, you know, there's another great metaphor to them. but we are talking about, you know, the political writings, people writing about their frustrations mm-hmm. with society, with the government, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Yeah.
When can you point to a time in your maturing literary wise where you went, wait, those are more than just words that are coming out of my radio. Mm-hmm. They mean something. And then they mean even more.
Yeah. I think I had the dawning sense of the connection between song lyric and literary poetry as early as my homeschooling years, in reading the romantic poets, Shelley and Keats and Wordsworth and Coleridge, and listening to you know, top 40, but also emerging hip hop music, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Curtis Blow, Kool Moe Dee, LL Cool J, those kinds of artists.
I got to give a shout out to Mike D and
Beastie Boys for sure, for sure. They were a big part of that moment as well. A little later,
but
it was only it took going to college and then to graduate school. It was really in graduate school that suddenly I discovered the vocabulary for making that connection, for saying, well, this is what is going on in the song lyric that makes it in the same conversation as literary poetry. And it took another professor, another person, another teacher, Helen Vendler, to make that clear to me.
Okay, so let's finish up Lewis and Clark here real quick. Yeah. You're still working on the Ellison stuff. How do you find, you're about to graduate. You had said before you were thinking you were going to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
You take the LSAT, the GRE. What made you, you knew you were going to grad school.
Yeah.
What made you decide grad school rather than law school? Although you said before you were still thinking you were going to law school after getting a master's.
I mean, that's getting a little ahead of the game, but yeah, it was once I had already decided to go to graduate school and I was at Harvard and I was going through what every PhD student goes through, which is a sense of where's your purpose? Where's your drive? And I remember sitting in the office of my advisor, Henry Louis Gates Jr., and saying, yeah, I think I got to go to law school. I think I want to leave it. Leave this behind and go to law school. And he said, just push through, get the dissertation written in the next year and a half, and then you can go to law school. He knew he was being tricky, because by the time I did all the work it took to finish that dissertation, there wasn't starting back in school for me, no more. but I made the choice because I saw something. I was following the intuition of Ellison and thinking there's something in how he went about his work and that craft of fiction that was deeply satisfying to me, and that I felt I could do something and distinguish myself in a way that maybe I wouldn't distinguish myself as readily in the legal profession, that I had an evolving set of skills that I was honing that could be put to work in the context of writing about literature, teaching it, and speaking about it to the general public that might make a real difference. So that was the evolution, and I applied to five schools and got into all of them and was choosing between Berkeley and Harvard. And the thing that made the difference again was a trip out to Harvard.
Well, it's Henry Louis Gates.
Yeah. Come on. And I was sitting in his office, and this is the thing, because I had met Gates the year before when I was a junior. He had come out for an event in Portland for this great artist, Jacob Lawrence. They were doing his migration series in Portland, and Professor Gates was doing a Q&A with him. And I remember getting all dressed up to go to the event, at least as I could in college, which was, you know, slacks, a button-up shirt, and this loud-ass tie. It was a flowered yellow and green and black and white. It just had all these colors on it. And I remember being so proud of that tie and knotting it just right. And so I went up to Professor Gates, and you know, tried to introduce myself. And I said, "Professor Gates, I'm a real fan of your work." I bet he's never heard that before. And I said, "I really want to come join you at Harvard someday." And he said, "Well, you have to bring your checkbook." He quipped. He said, "Hey, I like the tie." So I felt a little dejected after that. And so then fast forward a year, and I'm in his office, and they've offered me a full ride scholarship with a stipend of however many thousands. And I'm sitting in his office, and I reminded him of the moment. I said, look who brought their checkbook this time.
What'd you do with the tie?
I still have it to this day. Yeah, I still have it hanging in my closet. I kept it because it has that kind of emotional pull for me. But it was hard to say no. He said, you know, nobody says no to Harvard. And I said, well, I might just say no just because you said that. But it was just too many things going on. This was the moment in which they had what was soon dubbed the Dream Team in African American Studies at Harvard. Cornel West, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Lawrence Bobo, the sociologist. You know, they had pretty much everybody in all these key fields that was doing cutting edge work, and it was Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham as well, and a bunch of scholars that were doing amazing, amazing things. And it just felt like an electric time to be working on matters of race and culture at Harvard, and it proved to be the case.
What was the focus of study?
Initially, I came in obviously with this amazing thing on my resume that I could have just focused on.
So you were hoping stuff. You were thinking you were going to continue on the Ellison track.
Well, actually, I was in my perverse way. I said, I'm going to be the first person to write a dissertation about 20th century African American literature without using the word Ellison.
Okay.
So I was running a bit from Ellison because I came in with this reputation of being this kid who had done this work on Ellison. I think that was in part the strength upon which they admitted me, and I wanted to show other things. So I got the idea of looking at the matter of good and evil, and particularly the evil side, as it manifested itself in the literature by Black authors. So I spent years wrapping my mind around the philosophical and theological implications of evil, and finally put together a dissertation that allowed me to say a few things about that. But it's as I think I told you when we talked before, it's moldering in a file cabinet somewhere, maybe right over there.
Right.
I don't know.
But you're done with that.
Yeah.
You're not interested in building upon that. Was that? Do you think that turned out just to be maybe a needed exercise in order for you to better understand what it was that you wanted to accomplish later on? And then also what I also want to go back to is very early on in our conversation, I said, isn't it interesting that the rap lab is in the chemistry building? How is research different from a humanities perspective compared to the scientific? Because, I mean, what was the central question you were asking in your dissertation? Yeah. You wanted to look at how evil is dealt with in the writings of Black Americans.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
So how do you go about answering that question?
Yeah.
If a chemist has a question about, he poses it and then he goes through stepped laboratory analysis,
sure,
to get to find his answer. How do you, not necessarily spend a lot of time on the question you were answering
but
for your dissertation, but that methodology. Yeah. And then how are you using that here? Well, I've got a lot to talk about.
That's great. And I think at least on the level of analogy, it's very similar how we humanists and people in the sciences go about the work, in as much as you're animated by a question. And then you go about trying to answer the question through inductive and deductive methods, and you gather as much data as you can. And for me, that's still with what I do. That's the base of it. I gather as much data as I can. Now, the data may look different than it would for a scientist, although there are a number of people in literary studies doing instead of close reading, which is what I was taught, something more along the lines of distant reading. Moretti over at Stanford, at the Stanford Language Lab, has really branded that distant reading methodology, where you, instead of focusing in closely on a given text, you look at commonalities across a host of texts. So, I mean, in the American canon, for instance, we probably only study 5% of the literature written.
Right.
But what if you could look at the other 95, not in the same way as you'd look at Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, but in terms of questions about the titles that they use, or the character names, or things that you can quantify, things that you can use, big data techniques to explore. So, point being, I think there's a fusing and a blurring of the lines, where we in literary studies often annex other people's methodologies and bring into our own in useful and powerful ways. And I was starting to learn that at Harvard, seeing professors who were doing that very same thing, whether it's Elaine Scarry, who was, you know, using some scientific techniques in her scholarship, or a host of others who were annexing other fields in their own practices. So for me, I was always driven by my passion for music, not as a player, but as a avid fan and listener, and was attentive then to sound and to finding a vocabulary to describe sound. That's something that as a scholar of poetry, you're also trying to do, is what can you say as a critic of poetry that the poem itself doesn't already say? Well, in order to do that, you have to unpack some of the processes involved in the construction of it, some of the play of language that's apparent only to the most careful eye, the things that maybe influence us emotionally but don't catch our attention upon even multiple readings. Those are the things that critics can contribute to readers of poetry that the poem itself doesn't already do.
You get done with the dissertation. What do you do next? Do you go back to Ellison?
Yeah, well, so I get my first job, and it's after spending a year at Dartmouth on actually 2 years, one in a dissertation completion fellowship, and then on a postdoctoral fellowship, I head out to start my first tenure track position at Claremont McKenna College, part of the Claremont Colleges in Southern California, includes Pomona, Scripps, Harvey Mudd, places like that. And I'm out there, and the tenure clock is ticking. You know, for those of you who don't know, that you got X amount of years.
You got to publish or perish.
Yeah, to get that book out. And I spent a little time fooling with the dissertation, and even sent it out to an editor or two at a university press, and got lukewarm response. But the real lukewarm response was from me. As I read over the material, I just said, I'm not ready to do this now. I have to live longer, maybe, to write about evil. Maybe it'll be the last book I write rather than the first. So I tabled it. And that was a dangerous move, looking back, kind of a maybe even a foolhardy one. Now, as I think about it, it's certainly not something that I would advise my colleagues at the assistant professor level to do lightly, to just discard your dissertation, start a brand new book. But that's what I did. I started, in fact, two books, one on Ellison that I'd essentially been writing without putting pen to paper or fingers to keys since I was 19 years old, and then another about this emerging sense I had of hip-hop as a poetic form, rap music as a poetic practice. And I started writing both of those concurrently, in addition to rejoining John Callahan in bringing the second novel of Ellison's together, editing that together, which was a wonderful, wonderful process that enriched and informed both the Ellison book in direct ways, but also the hip-hop book in indirect ways, in the ways that Ellison thought about culture and wrote about it in his essays and in his novel. So yeah, it was in some ways a dangerous gambit to say I'm going to stake my career on my capacity to write at least one of these books and to the point of getting a contract before my tenure clock chimes.
It hasn't ended there, though.
No.
You're on book 7 or 8?
7 right now.
Okay.
Churning on it, yeah. And 8, actually. Yeah. I always have 2 things going at once.
And you just... You just finished one that you did a second edition on, or a revised edition on?
Of my first book is that book that it ended up being called Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop. And you know, you said something earlier, Ted, that I think is relevant for that book, which is that not a lot of people were thinking in terms of song, lyric, and poetry at the time. And this is fairly recently. So I was shopping the book in 2008. And sent it out to some of those same editors that had rejected my dissertation. And one of them, I who shall remain unnamed, but from Harvard University Press, sent me a one-page letter saying essentially this book, which I had written the bulk of, he said that it wasn't written in a way that was scholarly enough, that was theoretically engaged enough, that, you know, all of this. And he had the nerve to attach the pages that I had sent him for me to recycle them instead of him.
It's interesting that you mention that because Elizabeth Dunn, who actually was my first interview, and she taught here at CU for quite a long time, mentioned the same thing, that when she had been criticized by, lack of a better term, dumbing down the book and not making it as academic.
Yeah.
And she had really caught some flack for that.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that if we're talking about popular culture, and if the intent is to talk about popular culture, to bring in the masses as best that you can, when we're trying to academicize, is that a word? popular culture.
Yeah.
You can't expect that to be accepted by the pop culture folks if you don't speak to them.
Exactly. Why write a book about popular music? Why write a book about rap that someone who actually listens to rap wouldn't want to read?
Right.
And so that my goal was to keep the level of sophistication with the ideas, but to find a language that was more vibrant, more engaged, that had a sense of the rhythm and dynamism that the music itself had. And as a young writer, that was my goal, was to try to capture some of that energy that I loved in listening to Common rap, in listening to Lauryn Hill flow, in listening to Big Daddy Kane or Nas or Tupac or Biggie, to give that sensibility in the rhythms of my prose. And that's not for everybody. Now, I will say now that the university presses have caught up to that style of writing, and I'm seeing things coming out now from places, maybe not Harvard, but elsewhere, where there is this sense of an engagement with the register of language in the subject matter itself. So if you're writing about punk rock, to give that same sensibility to your prose to a certain extent, to allow those of us in academia to speak in human tones, to speak in tones that aren't solely in the rarefied place of jargon. Jargon has its place. It has its place in internal communications with scholars who need a shorthand to communicate ideas quickly to one another. But if our goal is really to reach out beyond the bounds of the university to engage with people who are already having these thoughts and ideas outside in the world at large, then we need to do our job in building a bridge through our language to reach them.
What were your follow-up books?
So after the Book of Rhymes, I moved on to doing an anthology of rap lyrics for Yale University Press. This was the first anthology ever published of rap lyrics. I edited it along with a grad school friend of mine and a professor at the University of Toronto, Scarborough, named Andrew Du Bois. And that was an endeavor just to try to wrestle this restless and at times chaotic language to the page, to have it temporarily rest on the page, knowing that, of course, rap lives in sound, in the clangor and noise of performance, but that there are certain things that are only visible when we slow it down and look at it carefully on the page. So we try to do that, and it's a great challenge, an evolving challenge, and something that we've also seen in recent years. The culture has witnessed a fascination with lyric, whether it's Genius, formerly rapgenius.com, that is a crowdsource annotation site with some expert curation as well from artists themselves, or Jay-Z's Decoded, the books by performers where they break down their lyrics. We were at the same moment that all of this is emerging, and it was a very wonderful time to have that happen. From then, I went on and worked with one of my hip-hop heroes, Common, on his memoir, which came out in 2011, a book called One Day It'll All Make Sense, written in his voice, where I had the writerly challenge of taking interviews that he and others had given to me, taking my experience of getting to know him, and creating a voice that was neither his nor mine, but somehow both. That was a wonderful, wonderful writerly challenge, something different from anything I had done in any of my other works. And then, of course, Ellison is the through line in all of this, helping John Callahan finally to publish that second novel of Ellison's that we titled 3 Days Before the Shooting. That includes that segment, Juneteenth, that we talked about earlier, but a sprawl of additional manuscripts, including those many of those pages that I worked on at 19 from the computer files, taking that sequence. And I was pretty proud of myself, my younger self, that I had done a fairly decent job lining up those sequences. And you know, it was a testament to the care and seriousness that I brought to it, even as a young, relatively untrained scholar.
And what's just come out? Or what are you working on next? Well,
the latest is a book called The Poetry of Pop. And it is a way to embrace the broad scope of music beyond rap, although including rap as well, that we listen to in the popular realm. So it goes everything from Tin Pan Alley music and early blues recordings all the way up to the present moment, Taylor Swift, The Weeknd, Migos, whatever's on the top 40 charts. And it looks at the function of language, the place of language as embedded in music, working with and against the music, and the music with and against the words, how all of this works through rhythm, rhyme, figurative language, voice, style, story, all of these components that account for the full richness of the experience of music, which is one that's sensory and also bounded by ideas as well, bounded by the language of thought and feeling. So that's this book, and I've been really pleased to see the reception of it from a lot of different communities, and pleased really to be able to embrace my full listening experience, because I've been kind of known and pigeonholed even as the rap guy. But some of my first album I bought on a CD was Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that wonderful debut. And you know, I've long been someone who embraced the full range of musical styles, from country to all forms of rock, into hip hop, electronic music, the gamut. And so it's exciting to be able to write about those things that matter so much to me.
Do you engage with artists when you're talking? Do you go back and do you talk to a Taylor Swift or a Weeknd to kind of get a feel for where they were at when they put together that lyric?
You know, with this book, my goal was consciously to avoid conversations with artists.
Because
there's a culture right now of, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's wonderful to have these artists speaking on their own music, but there's a culture of assuming that they have the final word. And if anything that I've taken from my literary studies is that it's just not the case. That as Philip Roth once said, and I'm probably paraphrasing him badly, but something along these lines, that when you write a work of fiction, it's like packing up a suitcase, walking into a crowded train station, leaving the suitcase on the ground and walking out. You know, that yes, you packed it, you put it together, but there'll be other people who open it up and rifle through it and take what they want from it and overlook what they don't want, and that's what happens with music as well. So I wanted to come from that perspective as someone decidedly on the outside of the music industry, looking at what these artists have created through the lens of what I study, which is literature and music. And I think there's something there. That said, I love working with artists, and in my latest project, I'm working at least at a distance with one of the greatest artists in hip-hop history, a late great artist whom I can't mention at
That's
the
fine.
Moment. And I'm doing the first authorized biography of this artist, and it's a tremendous, tremendous gift, but also a certain degree of burden to tell a big story like this, big canvas on which to tell this narrative of an artist who still matters to so many people so much after, you know, a couple decades. So that's the one I'm in the mix of right now, in addition to doing an annotated digital version of Invisible Man, taking me back to my roots as a young scholar, burgeoning scholar, as an undergrad, and helping young people of this generation have their first experience with this book, helping bring them into the conversations that the book invites, helping draw certain connections from the contemporary moment to this novel that's now, you know, decades old, and you know, show how it can be renovated, renewed, how the it doesn't age, it's evergreen as a novel in that regard, as great classics are.
Yeah, it's interesting. My kids, we're almost at 90 minutes here. We'll wrap it up, but I want to touch on one real quick thing here. Yeah. Is going back and to those classics as a middle-aged guy. It's my head's going back and understand where kind of my headspace was when I read the book that I go back to is Fahrenheit 451.
Oh yeah, yeah.
To understand that he wrote that Ray Bradbury wrote that in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And the ideas that he had looking forward, mm-hmm. the idea of the video wall and the family, he was talking about reality television. Now I'm going to have to go back and read Ellison in yeah. The Invisible Man
oh, yeah.
as a soon-to-be 50-year-old guy. Yeah. It is going to, yeah, I'm going to need to prepare the brain to be blown. but it's going to be interesting
yeah.
when you talk about reimagining, I think that's what I'm hearing you say, reimagining the Invisible Man for this digital age.
Mm-hmm.
How do you present that
mm-hmm.
to kids of all colors and all races and all backgrounds?
Yes.
Because those are still ideas that are very important, even in today's society. As we take a look at, you know, the New York Times today had an article about, you know, a very definitive study about the divide that has come about mm-hmm. because of income disparity.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that.
So how do you take those ideas that Ellison had 70 oh, years ago and place that in today's context in order for the kid of today to draw from it? They can.
Yeah.
I think that there's still the greatest value you can get is reading the printed word.
Yes, yes.
The reality of it is that we have so much input going into these kids' brains that you can't necessarily get to them with the printed word. You need to backdoor that yeah. to get to that point.
Yeah. Yeah, although I've seen some recent writing about it seems promising that there's a return to text to actual printed materials
right.
of, and that can, I think, can be a good thing because it has the capacity to focus, to hone our minds in closely on one object of attention, and that's always a wonderful thing to have as well. But yeah, it's going to be exciting to think about Invisible Man in this moment with all that's going on in our country politically and socially, with all the ways that this particular this youngest generation, my children, are inheriting a world that by some obvious measures is far, far improved from the world that Ellison knew when he was writing the novel, but still has these persistent tensions, persistent and dogged inequalities that mark our nation in this moment. So it's something. It's something to be some part, to play some role in continuing Ellison's legacy is something I take great, great pride in doing, and something that I think will always be a part of my life as a scholar.
All right, last question. What was the last new album you bought?
Last new album, I think it was Kendrick Lamar on vinyl. I mean, that's the thing. I've been turning to vinyl a lot. Our friend Andy at Albums on the Hill.
I'm no longer allowed to bring home vinyl that my wife knows about.
Yeah. So I keep all my vinyl. I'm the same way. I keep all my vinyl over here in the lab that we're in, and we have a listening room, dedicated listening room, acoustical foam all over the place, and I can blast my music. So I think I had a Kendrick, and then I think I got the Beatles' White Album. So I just finished a piece on looking at the White Album these many decades later and the impact that it's had. That'll be coming out next year on the 60th anniversary?
I think so.
Yeah.
No, not
50th. 50th, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. 50th anniversary of the White Album. So I'm excited to have that piece. I'm writing about the White Album, Jay-Z's Black Album, and then Danger Mouse's Gray Album, which mixes the two together in some fascinating ways. So I picked up the White Album and I picked up Kendrick Lamar's Damn the other day on vinyl.
Well, Adam Bradley, thank you very much. This was a lot of fun. Really appreciate your time.
Absolute pleasure, Ted. Thank you.
Well, let's go up to Album, shall we?
Let's do it.
A big thank you again to Adam Bradley. Really had a great time chatting with Adam up at the Rap Lab up at the University of Colorado Boulder. The place is in my blood. Anyway, I also need to say, give a big thanks to Andy Schneidkraut up at Albums on the Hill. Again, Andy, you've introduced me to some great people, and really appreciate the efforts that you've made to help me get this podcast going. It means a ton. And yes. I'll be back up in Boulder here in a couple of weeks again for some more interviews. I have one in the can. Again, thanks to Andy. How about an evolutionary biologist? It's quite the journey as well. Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Check us out on any of your podcast distribution channels. If this is the first time you've been listening, check out the past episodes. Leave me comments. Tell me what you think. Check out my website, themountaingeek.net. Also on the social media, at themountaingeek on Twitter. And Piled High and Deep, the podcast on Twitter. Have a great day. And keep shoveling.